On the day of Tisha B'Av, we mourn a number of events in Jewish history, the most outstanding of which are the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple, and of the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple. There is, of course, a more recent catastrophe which has occurred to the Jewish people, and that is the catastrophe of the Holocaust, of the Shoah, of the destruction of a third of our people, and the almost total eradication of Eastern European and Central European Jewry. And so the question is there room on Tisha B'Av? Is there a place on Tisha B'Av for reflection and mourning and understanding the Holocaust? In the kinos, which I have been privileged to give in various venues for more than 20 years now, I always include reference to the Holocaust, as well as special kinos which were written on the occasion of this terrible, terrible catastrophe. In this talk today, I would like to reflect with you not on the events of Tisha B'Av that you can read about in Megillas Eicha, in Sefer Yirmiyahu, in the Gemara, and in the history books going back thousands of years. Rather, I will talk to you today about certain aspects of the Holocaust and how they fit into Tisha B'Av. First of all, I want to share with you the experience of a man who I consider one of my teachers and mentors. His name was Rav Yitzchok Sternhill, and he was a rav of a small shul in Baltimore that I would frequent back in my pre-rabbinic days. He was a survivor of the Holocaust and had many stories to tell about what was lost and about his experiences and how he survived. He was a Hasidish Yid, actually a student of the yeshiva in Munkach, of the Minchas Elozor. And he held very strongly that there should be an official special day designated as a day, a memorial day for the Holocaust. As I recall, he contacted and perhaps even visited Eretz Yisrael, Israel, in the 1950s, to visit with the Chazon Ish, with the Chepinerov, with the Briskerov, the Gedolei Yisrael of that time, to ask them to lead the designation of a day as a memorial day for the Jewish people, just to focus on the Holocaust. He was not successful. They turned him down. For various reasons, they felt that this was not the thing to do. He disagreed and would talk for many years about how he disagreed. Those who disagree and feel that one should not have a special day all agree that reflection about the Holocaust does have a place in at least one day of the year, and that is the day of Tisha B'Av. Rashi, in his commentary on Divrei Hayomim, says that Tisha B'Av is a general day, a day for a general mourning of all Jewish calamities and tragedies and catastrophes over our entire history. And of course, Rashi did not know about the Holocaust, the pogroms, the Spanish Inquisition. He lived long before all of these events. But given his view of Tisha B'Av as a broad and comprehensive day of national mourning, it would be appropriate to mourn for all of those tragedies. But this question of does the Holocaust deserve a special day, or should it just be incorporated into Tisha B'Av, reflects a different sort of discussion, which to me is extremely important. And that is, was the Holocaust simply another pogrom, another aspect of the Jewish experience in exile in the diaspora in the Golos, larger in scope, more tragic in terms of numbers, in terms of the misos mishunos, the horrible deaths and tortures, gas chambers, shootings, buried alive, etc., that were part of the Holocaust? Yes. But basically, it was just one other event in an ongoing chain of events, which go back very far, perhaps to the destruction of the first and second temple, and may even continue to this day with the various difficulties and tragedies with which we still are confronted. That's one point of view. And that, incidentally, was the point of view of Rav Yitzchak Huttner, who wrote as much. The Holocaust was terrible. It was of a great magnitude in quantity. But in quality, it was simply another expression of the horrible experience of Golos. If one takes that view, one can understand why the Holocaust would not deserve a special day of mourning, but would be included in Tisha B'Av when we mourn all aspects of the Golos. There is, however, another point of view, and that is that the Holocaust was unique and different. It's a Latin expression, sui, S-U-I, generis, G-E-N-E-R-I-S, which means something in itself, something unique and different. This is the view, for example, of the great Slonimer Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Levrocha, the Nesivo Sholom, who writes in one of his essays, one of his pamphlets, on the subject of the Holocaust, that from the time that man was created, there was never a tragedy like this. It's unique, it's different. And this is the opinion of many others. And if we follow that approach, perhaps the Holocaust does deserve a special Memorial Day. But even if we include the Holocaust in our Tisha B'Av rubric, in our Tisha B'Av framework, nevertheless, we want to pay attention to the uniqueness of the Holocaust. I want to share with you the opinion of a great historian, a man named Professor Stephen T. Katz, whom I actually met personally. He is the father of Mrs. Shira Reifman, who formerly worked for NCSY and now lives in Eretz Yisrael. Remarkable woman in her own right. Professor Katz is the author of a multi-volume work, which I recommend to you, although it's heavy reading and a heavy book, literally. It's called The Holocaust in Historical Context. And in this book, Professor Katz insists that the Holocaust must be understood as being unique, being absolutely unique. And he writes a great deal about the uniqueness of the Holocaust. He compares, for example, the Holocaust to the Gulag experience in the former Soviet Union, which was also a horrible, horrible experience, and in which millions of people also died. But nevertheless, he sees the Holocaust as something different. I recommend this book to you because he argues his point very well over the course of perhaps 1,000 pages. But I just want to share with you today what he calls the basic claim, the claim that he insists upon, that one must recognize the uniqueness of the Holocaust. And here's what he writes. To facilitate an understanding of the philosophical argument to be developed, I here provide my definition of the notion of phenomenological uniqueness as it applies to the Shoah, to the Holocaust. Definition. The Holocaust is phenomenologically unique. I suggest that you consult a dictionary to understand fully what the word phenomenologically means. It means, in terms of the experience, the inner experience, it is a unique experience. What makes it unique, writes Professor Katz? By virtue of the fact that never before has a state set out as a matter of intentional principle and actualized policy to annihilate physically every man, woman, and child belonging to a specific people. This is his definition of the uniqueness of the Holocaust. I personally wonder, wasn't the plot of Haman exactly such a Holocaust? Of course, the answer there might be that Haman's plot was foiled. But there are other aspects to the Holocaust which make it exceptionally unique. And I want to focus on some of them in this talk today. The Holocaust is unique in terms of its scope. 6 million people who lived from the shores of the Atlantic, Spain and Portugal and Holland and the Netherlands, all the way into the depths of Russia, from the northern countries of Scandinavia to the southern countries of southern Italy and Greece, and even islands in the Mediterranean, such as Rhodes and Cyprus. 6 million people were killed. Interestingly, evidence now indicates that it might have been even more than 6 million, because now we are uncovering data, historical data, about the murders and shootings and beatings and genocide of Jews living well east of the Russian border, into the Ukraine, etc. This scope makes it unique. One of the problems with the uniqueness of the scope, the vastness of the tragedy of the Holocaust, is that it is hard to relate emotionally to a number like 6 million. It is hard to relate emotionally to a number like 1 million, like 100,000. How do you recognize, how can you take in such a vast tragedy? When we see a specific family, such as recently, the Fogel family in Itamar, 5 individuals, mother, father, 3 children, 1 an infant, barely a few months old, that somehow we can relate to. We can see pictures of them. We can speak to people who knew them. We can relate, and our pain is insurmountable. But 6 million, how does one relate to it? Interestingly, in my own presentations over the course of the years on Tisha B'Av, I strive to individualize, to humanize, to make the victims flesh and blood that we can relate to in various ways. And one of the things I do is I refer to one of the kinos, which is a kino, a lament for an individual person, not for the whole great national tragedy. And I refer to the kino, which begins with the words in Divrei Hayomim, Vayikonein Yirmiyahu al Yoshiyahu. This is a kino, a lament for one individual, Yoshiyahu, King Josiah. Yes, a king, but nevertheless, a specific single human person. Because sometimes we get so swept away with numbers and grand tragedies that we forget the individual and his or her suffering and pain and what they meant, what they stood for. Each person, after all, in himself or herself is a olam umeloo, is a world, a universe in themselves. So this is an important aspect of Tisha B'Av and of the Holocaust. There's another aspect of the Holocaust which makes it somewhat unique. And that is the role played by the church, by the Christian church, specifically the Roman Catholic Church. Interestingly, as Rabbi Soloveitchik notes in his commentary on the Kinos, which OU Press published just last year, time and again he points out that the allusions in the various Kinos to Rome or to Edom don't always or only refer to the Rome of old, ancient Rome, the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was basically a pagan country. The Rome that is often alluded to is the Rome of Christianity, the Rome of the history of Christianity and its persecution of the Jews, and how, for Christianity, the Holocaust was in a certain sense a fulfillment of what was supposed to be happening to the Jewish people. Jewish people, according to old Christian theology nowadays, certain leaders in the Catholic Church are trying to modify that. But in the old history, the Jews deserve not only to be wandering, to be in exile, but they also deserve to suffer and to suffer bitterly. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes in one of his commentaries, and you can find it in this particular version of the Kinos, page 201, at times of catastrophe, the element of Chilul Hashem becomes insufferable. During the Holocaust years, writes Rav Soloveitchik, Christian clergymen argued that God had abandoned the Jews and allowed the complete destruction of the Jewish people, thus fulfilling the words of their Bible. Rav Soloveitchik writes, on a personal note, I was confronted by these arguments, and I used to cry not only for the churban, for the destruction, but for the terrible desecration of God's name that these arguments represented. Rabbi Soloveitchik ends this paragraph by saying, the significance of the establishment of the State of Israel was that it put a stop to these arguments. I'm not sure, with all deference to the Rav, that the establishment of the State of Israel really did put a stop to all those arguments in all quarters. But Christianity as the context which allowed a Holocaust to happen is something about the Holocaust that makes it unique and something that bears study and understanding. I want to refer to another comment of Rav Soloveitchik in his comments on the Kinos. And that is on page 410, the following statement. He's commenting on Kino, which is normally called Kino 20. The Kino written by Elazar HaKalir, which begins Hatei Elokai Oznecha, which in my translation reads, incline your ear, my God, to the fearful and scandalous cry. Rav Soloveitchik writes, this Kino by Rabbi Elazar HaKalir is directed against Christian Rome and the church, not ancient Rome, and concerns Chilul Hashem, Chilul Shem Shamayim, the desecration of God's name. Perhaps the main motif of this kina can be characterized as Chilul Shem HaGadol Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bagoyim. Again and again, Rav Soloveitchik in his commentary returns to the theme of the culpability of Christian Rome and how even in ancient Piyutim, by everyone agrees that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir lived long before the Middle Ages, perhaps in the 8th, 9th century, perhaps long further back than that. Nevertheless, he had this image of Christian Rome in his mind as he composed his Lamentations. There is something else which makes the Holocaust unique, and that is, because of its scope, because of its terror, because of the unbelievable success that it had, Hitler's design was to achieve a, quote, final solution. And he came quite close to that. He really did free many, many countries in Europe from their Jewish populations. Lithuania, Latvia, to this day, you can count the number of Jews who live there on one hand. Poland, perhaps a few thousand Jews remain there, perhaps less. Countries which had tens, hundreds, millions of Jews living there. So perhaps because of that scope, and perhaps because of the nature of our times, the Holocaust has provoked great theological questions. How could a just and good God allow such a thing to happen? And to happen not in one grand explosion, but to happen over 6 years, over a vast swath of territories. How could God allow this to happen? What kind of a God would allow this to happen? And theologians of all types and stripes, Jews, non-Jews, have struggled with this issue. And some people, because of these questions, both philosophers and ordinary people, have come to abandon their belief in God, or abandon their belief in a just and good God, or abandon their belief in an all-powerful God because of these questions. How does one deal with these questions? Unfortunately, in our traditional religious rabbinic leadership, very, very little has been written about the theological implications of the Holocaust and what we are to make of them. But there are certain works which do struggle with the issues. They may not provide easy answers, but they do struggle with the issues. And I'm going to recommend two of these works to you today. One is this book called Faith After the Holocaust. And it is written by Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, Berkowitz. Rabbi Berkowitz was a student of Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the author of the Sri Deyesh. Indeed, one of Rabbi Berkowitz's tshuvos, responsa, appears in the work Sri Deyesh. He was a remarkable person. I met him and heard him once in my life. Toward the end of his life, actually the end of his life he spent in Israel, but the end of his professional rabbinic life was in the city of Chicago. And this book is well worth reading. And I'd like to share with you some of his ideas. First of all, his opening statement in the introduction to this work deserves stress and emphasis. There are two principal approaches, writes Berkowitz, to the Holocaust of European Jewry. One is the attitude of pious submission. It's a manifestation of divine will. That's one way. I don't know, I don't understand the answer, but tzidukatin, I surrender. Surrender my thoughts, surrender my questions. It's divine will. Then there's also what Berkowitz calls the more frequently met attitude of questioning and doubt, a position that may ultimately lead to outright rebellion against the very idea of a beneficent providence. And then Rabbi Berkowitz offers these words of caution. Those of us who were not there must heed the responses of those who were, for theirs alone are the authentic ones. Those of us who know of the Holocaust from afar, from books or films, or even from accounts of survivors, dare not take a position one way or the other on the Holocaust. That privilege of either submitting to the will of God or challenging the notion, the concept of a God, that privilege is reserved for those who were there. Theirs alone are the authentic responses. Many who were lost their faith. I can understand them, writes Berkowitz, and I can understand them. I'm sure you can understand them. A hell fiercer than Dante's was their lot. I believe that God himself understands and does not hold their loss of faith against them. But I was not there myself. There were others in the thousands, tens of thousands, who were there and did not lose their faith, who accepted what happened to them in awesome submission to the will of God. I, who was not there, cannot reject. How dare I reject if they accept it? Neither can I accept. I, who was not there because I was not there, dare not accept, dare not submit, because my brothers in their tens of thousands who did go through that hell did rebel and did reject. So Rabbi Berkowitz presents a kind of a bind that we are in if we were not there ourselves. We can't say, take the pious attitude, it's the will of God, the will of God. That's almost a desecration of those who died and those who suffered. On the other hand, we can't take the other view and reject God, because what about those many, many, many survivors who came out of the Holocaust with a greater faith and greater piety and greater commitment to Judaism than they had going into the Holocaust? So those of us who are not actual survivors, although in a certain sense we are all survivors, but those of us who do not experience it ourselves can't go one way or the other. We're stuck in the middle. And this stuckness is part of the Tisha B'Av experience when we reflect on the Holocaust. We can't solve the theological puzzle, but that frustration must capture our experience on this day. Berkowitz has more to say. For one thing, he insists that the acquiescence of the West, the fact that the great countries of the West, including to some extent the United States of America, ignored, acquiesced, didn't do what they could in the face of the Holocaust, is, in the words of Berkowitz, a damnation of Western civilization, of Western culture. One must wonder, how could the Holocaust come out of the German culture? Germany was the pride of Western civilization. German philosophers, poets. This is the country of Goethe. This is the country of the Immanuel Kant. This is the country which preached and taught ethics and morality and philosophy, etc., through philosophical writings, through literature. Out of that, how could this barbaric, sadistic culture emerge? This is a question not only against Germany, but a question against Western civilization itself. And that, too, is a question that we must feel on this day of Tisha B'Av. And he has special words, damning words, for the Vatican. He writes, by its attitude toward the fate of the Jewish people, the Vatican lost all claim to moral and spiritual leadership in the world. And he goes on to tell various stories, but one of the most gripping stories is the story that happened to Rav Weissmandel. Rav Weissmandel was a rabbi, a Rosh Yeshiva, in a yeshiva in what is today Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic. And he had various connections to leaders of the church, including a Catholic priest named Tiso, T-I-S-S-O. At one point, Weissmandel escaped a train which was going to deport him to Auschwitz. And he succeeded in making his way to the residence of the papal nuncio. He described to His Eminence the conditions of the families in the camp and asked for his immediate intervention with Tiso. Upon his urging, he received the following answer, quote, "This being a Sunday is a holy day for us. Neither I nor Father Tiso occupy ourselves with profane matters on this day." This was the rejection he received. Two highly placed churchmen don't occupy themselves with the profane matters of Jewish lives on the holy day of Sunday. Weissmandel wondered how the blood of infants and children could be considered a profane matter. He was told, quote, "There is no innocent blood of Jewish children in the world. All Jewish blood is guilty. You have to die. This is the punishment that has been awaiting you because of that sin." Of course, meaning the death of Jesus. This is a theme which one must reflect upon on the day of Tisha B'Av. I want to continue a bit more with some of the points that Rabbi Berkowitz makes in this absolutely essential book, required reading, Faith After the Holocaust. Page 41 in the book. It is our responsibility to sum up the meaning of that era, guided exclusively by our own experience, in terms of the Jewish experience, in the lands of Christendom. The final result of that age is bankruptcy, the moral bankruptcy of Christian civilization, and the spiritual bankruptcy of the Christian religion. After 19 centuries of Christianity, the extermination of 6 million Jews, among them 1.5 million children, carried out in cold blood in the very heart of Christian Europe, encouraged by the criminal silence of virtually all Christendom, including that of an infallible Holy Father in Rome, was the natural culmination of this bankruptcy. Eloquent words, and words for Tisha B'Av. Rabbi Berkowitz has no easy answers, but he also turns to certain positive directions, and I want to share one of them with you. He insists that throughout one's study of the Holocaust, one must be impressed by single isolated incidents, by those righteous Gentiles, by those non-Jews who did defy the Nazis, who did save Jews, risking their lives and the lives of their families. I want to mention one such person because I happen to be reading a biography about him now. His name was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, B-O-N-H-O-E-F-F-E-R, and he was a Christian minister, a Lutheran minister, if I'm not mistaken. And he returned from the United States in 1939 to go back to Germany, where he was born and lived and was ordained and had a church, because he wanted to see what he could do to stop the threat of Nazism. And of course, he was not successful. He participated in the plot to assassinate Hitler. He saved Jews in a variety of ways. And I'm reading a biography of him now by a man named Metaxas, M-E-T-A-X-A-S, and I recommend that book to you, because there are shining lights even among the German people themselves. But Berkowitz is especially interested in the shining lights of certain Jews. And he writes, "Let a few examples stand for what we mean by the experience of the nobility of existence, even next door to the crematoria. One of the survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto tells a story of how he and a woman were sought by the Gestapo. They were chased for weeks, living continually under the shadow of imminent death, changing their hiding place from day to day, until finally they were trapped behind the accumulated garbage of a ghetto attic. The man was determined to sell his life dearly. As the Gestapo policeman approached his corner, he jumped forward and grabbed him by the throat. The policeman went limp in his hand, completely at his mercy. At this moment, quote, Sonia, the woman companion, ran from her hiding place and shouted hysterically, 'Don't kill him, don't kill him.' What manifestation of human dignity in this Jewish woman, who after having been stalked by death for weeks became hysterical at the thought that her companion in hiding should kill their pursuer." Writes Rabbi Berkowitz, "At that moment there was no place on earth holier than that dark and dusty corner in that attic in the Warsaw Ghetto. It was the holy of holies on earth, sharing in the very majesty of Sinai, when God descending upon it proclaimed his 'Thou shalt not kill.' Who knows whether that wretched little attic was not wrapped in even greater majesty than Sinai. At Sinai, God proclaimed in the ghetto a hunted human being, at the risk of her own life, enacted God's commandment." Again, there's much more in this book than I'm sharing with you, and I recommend it to you. I want to recommend another author who writes about the Holocaust in a way that's helpful, very helpful, especially to a religious Jew, to a believing Jew. His name was Rav Yehuda Leon Ashkenazi, also known by his French name Monito, who was a Rav and a professor and a teacher in France, who spent the last years of his life in Israel. And various of his works are being published these days. I commend to you the website which has his works. The website is www.manitou.org.il. manitou.org.il. And in that website, you can focus on just his writings and teachings about the issue of the Holocaust. The book I have before me, which is called Mispeid LeMoshiach, A Eulogy for the Messiah, One whole section of the book, the Sha'ar HaSheni, the second gate, is devoted to the whole issue of the Holocaust. And he has much to say. For one thing, he begins by pointing out something which we should not forget, and that is that the Nazi threat and the Holocaust did not only affect Jews. Many, many millions of other individuals, non-Jewish individuals, were also murdered brutally in one way or other by the Nazis. Auschwitz had many, many Polish political prisoners, German political prisoners, who had nothing to do with Judaism or Jewishness, who also suffered. Rav Ashkenazi wishes us to understand that the Holocaust was a universal event. The Jews had a place in it. Perhaps our suffering in some ways was greater, but who can measure human suffering? Perhaps it was different in some way. Perhaps it was unique. But we cannot escape the fact that other human beings were also involved and also victims. He makes that point very strongly. And he speaks about the various explanations that have been given from a religious point of view about how God could allow this to be. And he rejects almost all of them. Could the Holocaust have been a punishment for some sin? Can that be? What sins did we commit that could deserve such a extermination? And why did those who did not commit those sins, why did they also perish? Very important questions, very important observations. Interestingly, he explains the theory of some extremists, perhaps, in the religious camp, in our religious camp, who believe that in some way the Holocaust was a punishment for Zionism, of all things, because we dared to establish, or try to establish at that point, a Jewish state, defying the oaths against hastening the redemption, against taking the redemption into our own hands. And he writes very movingly, but how can that possibly be? How can a rational person believe that? But he does point out that more and more people within the religious camp, within the Orthodox camp, the Haredi camp, have come to believe this. He does not refer to one of my favorite works, which I also commend to you, the work by Harav Yisachar Teichtal called Eim Habonim Smecha, in which he rejects any such approach that would attribute the Holocaust to the misled Zionist enterprise. Quite the contrary, argues Rav Teichtal. If there was any sin, it was not being Zionistic enough. It was not engaging and participating in the construction of a then not quite yet born Jewish state. So I commend to you also the works of Rav Yehuda Leon Ashkenazi Monitu about this topic. There's much more to be said. And in my own presentations this year on Tisha B'Av itself, the day of Tisha B'Av, I, of course, will be speaking about the Holocaust among many, many other topics. And I refer you to those of my previous presentations, which are archived on the OU website, OU.org. But I want to commend to you two other sources of information, especially about the religious response to the Holocaust. One is the project of the Michlala, the College for Women in Yerushalayim. They've produced a number of very interesting materials, especially materials that are good for educational purposes for the young. And I commend you to their website, www.michlala.edu. That's michlala.edu. And look for the RAB, R-A-A-B, Holocaust Education Center. Excellent archival material, excellent educational material, curricular for all sorts of people of all ages and all backgrounds. And finally, I want to commend to you a specific Institute of Holocaust Research that I happen to be involved with, and I am on their board of directors. And this is an institute known as Shem Olam, in English, Shem, S-H-E-M, Olam, O-L-A-M. And it is located off the beaten path, if you visit Israel, in Kfar Haroeh, on the same campus as the famous yeshiva, Ibn Akiva yeshiva there. And this is a very, very special museum and research institute where you can find all sorts of interesting archival material, all sorts of interesting diaries, photographs, paintings, letters written as a religious response to the Holocaust. I remember just some of the things that I've seen there in my various visits there. One that just always grabbed me was a little notebook, which was kept by a Rav in a small shtetl in Poland. And in this notebook, he listed the chometz, which was brought to him by various Jews over the years. So it was a poor town, and every year this Jew came with a few sacks of flour to sell, mechiras chometz, and this Jew with some, perhaps some liquor, which was chometz. This shtetl became a ghetto during the Nazi occupation of Poland. And pretty soon this rabbi was not just selling the chometz of 10, 20 families, but rather of 100, 200 families. And in the midst of the hunger and deprivation of the Holocaust years, Jews went to this rabbi before Pesach and sold their chometz. What do they have? A spoonful of this, a small bag full of that. But they were careful to sell their chometz, and he was careful to record it. And that diary you can hold, as I did, hold it in your hands. And that transports you to a place where we all are on Tisha B'Av. I commend to you, finally, the website of Shem Olam, which is www.shemolam, one word, S-H-E-M-O-L-A-M, .org.il. You'll see there an abundance of material, which you can consult perhaps even on Tisha B'Av Day, and it will deepen and intensify your appreciation for what the Holocaust meant and means to every decent human being, and certainly to every faithful Jew. Let me just close with the prayer that perhaps this year the prophecy of the Navi Zechariah will be realized, and all of the sad days of the Jewish calendar, Tisha B'Av at the top, will be transformed from days of mourning into days of joy and celebration. Thank you.